All right. Good to be with you. It is Father's Day. I feel like it snuck up on me too, Judy, and I'm a dad. I'm a father. So you'd think I'd be paying attention. But somehow maybe it's just the bigger rhythms of this season. This spring, which feels like even though today feels very summery, it's felt like kind of a slow-mo beginning to that season in some ways. Maybe that's it, I don't know. But hearing people sort of touch on that, and Judy hearing your own reflections about your dad brought to mind a moment with my dad, who's I'm fortunate to have a good a happy a soul-filling legacy from my dad. Really good associations when I think about my dad, who's also passed away a few years ago. But if I was going to try to single out a particular, if I was going to try to single out a particular memory this morning about my dad, I would say that one of the primary things that my dad gifted to me was curiosity. Just this sort of unceasing interest in the wider world and how things work or don't. Why they work the way they work, how we can kind of where we have agency, where we can sort of fiddle with things or make things ourselves, or find solutions or improvise solutions, all that kind of thing. So the curiosity feels like a real gift from my dad. Also, I can remember in particular, in the context of what we're exploring this morning, I have a particular memory from my dad, which is I remember the moment where he sort of had this aha. As a person who had, whose personal faith, who would have identified as a Christian, in terms of his religion, and his practice, and his community, would have been very involved in the formation of the religious community that he was part of in the town where we grew up. Very engaged, someone who taught other people. Or kind of more like, I think my dad's teaching was more like leading, exploring, maybe a little bit more like what happens here at the table, but very involved that way through his whole adult life. And I can remember all of that as background. I can remember the moment where he kind of looked at me and said, I had this encounter with a person of another faith. It was through his work in the construction industry, but someone who's very devout Muslim. And really engaged in that practice, and it had deeply formed their life and character. And my dad just saying, it doesn't really make sense to me anymore that this idea that Christianity is sort of the only way to God. Like that just doesn't make any sense. And he wasn't suddenly not a Christian. He wasn't sort of jumping his religious ship. He was just, in some ways, he was just like, this just isn't the only one. That doesn't make any sense. We'll come back to that, but to me, that's a joyful legacy. That's a real gift. We gathered this morning on Treaty One. I come to this moment grateful for the stewardship of the land, and increasingly, as the years go by, grateful also for the stewardship of the traditions and the practices and the perspectives on what is not seen, as well as how we would care for what we can see and touch. I feel increasingly personally informed by the recovery and the renewed practice of ancient beliefs, and which is kind of a curious experience to have for someone who grew up, being taught by people who thought deeply about what is also a religion that has its roots in ancient beliefs. But I sort of feel like the circle just keeps getting bigger. And in my life, my Indigenous friends and the First Nations communities and Indigenous peoples here on this continent feel like they just, advertently or otherwise, they just keep gifting me new and bigger perspectives, for which I'm very grateful. All right, let's get into this. So far in this series on seeing religions in 3D, we've mostly been using a pretty wide-angle lens, so to speak, or circling things to try to get different lenses on them. And today we're going to focus a little bit on the Christian religion. And perhaps in ways that might be difficult for those that have been really harmed by their time in and around that religion or by people that claim it as part of their identity. And I know there's a good percentage of people who might resonate with that description in our community. So just a bit of a heads up that we're going to get into that a bit deeper today, and an open invitation, as always, to only wade as far into that stream as you choose. If we were in a physical space this morning, I would want to say, do not feel bad about walking out of the room. This is not the sort of stuff to stay proximate to if it's re-traumatizing or distressing, or you feel like you're doing it out of a sense of oughtness that does not arise from within you, but from outside or from vertical authority or from fear. Let's explore because we choose to, and not because of those negative things to the degree that we're able. My hope with that wide angle or circling kind of exploration has been that this would help us all to consider our broader context, to think more like, I would say, humans in general, rather than humans that believe thing X. In the early going, the main reason I think that's important is because it can better equip us to be spiritual explorers in this space, culturally speaking, this moment in time, in this particular place and culture, the place where we find ourselves. We live in a multicultural, multi-ethnic, pluralistic society, and that's not the context where many of the beliefs we've been handed have been most deeply formed. And so the characteristics of those beliefs as cultural linguistic entities often doesn't match the context that we're in. And so we need to revisit this. We need to explore this. It's also important because that kind of exploration can help us to make way for, I would say, more genuine or deeper compassion. If you've been following along, you might remember that we've seen that over time, the main goal of all of the main religions has been transformation at a deep level, and particularly as regards the transformation of the humans that are engaged in that religious practice so that we would become more compassionate persons. That's the goal. And we've seen that this is the kind of thing that happens when we actually enter into something, as opposed to when we just sort of just believe or give assent to a particular set of creeds or doctrines, which is a lot of what the Christian religion has become about in the contemporary West. It's about, what do you believe? Do you believe this? Do you believe that? And so on. Been quite a while in our community since we've focused on compassion in particular. I'm not going to suddenly change directions to do that. But given the importance of that value in what we're exploring, I do want to pause to remind us all just sort of briefly of what compassion is and what it isn't. The word itself, the meaning carrier itself, literally means to suffer together. And we could say that compassion is a feeling that becomes an action. If we were going to try to sum it up the way that most emotional researchers these days would see this word, we could say that compassion is the feeling that arises when we are confronted with another's suffering and we feel motivated to relieve that suffering. And inherent in the suffering together idea is that we aren't relieving that suffering from a distance. We're relieving it by sharing it in some way. So it's not the same as empathy. Very similar, but not the same, because empathy is the capacity to understand or feel what another person is experiencing from within their frame of reference, or to place ourselves in another's position. Placing ourselves in another's position is something that sort of really only works as an idea, at least if we're going to try to have a complete orb of it. A little different from compassion in that regard. It's also distinguishable from another similar idea, which is altruism. Altruism is the belief or practice of disinterested or selfless concern. By disinterested, we don't mean not interested in the other party, but not interested in ourselves. So the practice of disinterested or selfless concern for the well-being of others. So the altruist may be a very wealthy person who gives away lots of money, which could be done out of concern for the well-being of others without entering into their suffering, right? Compassion is an entering in. So in the context of what we've been exploring, perhaps the most meaningful distinction at this point is that, or the most meaningful kind of overlap with that, is the together part of compassion. I find it quite intriguing that becoming more compassionate persons requires entering into something. It requires entering into transformation itself in a whole person sort of way. We actually have to go there. So to become more compassionate, we have to be more compassionate, if that makes sense. We can't have it just as an idea. That wouldn't be compassion. It would be more likely to be empathy or altruism, for example. Compassion means you're in there. And yeah, so perhaps we could say that becoming more compassionate requires the same kind of commitments and actions as being more compassionate does. So to become it, we have to be it. To be it, we have to become it. It's very intertwined. That what comes to mind is Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching about loving your enemies. Han liked to say that to love someone, you have to get to know them. So if you have an enemy and you get to know them, by the time you get to know them, they're no longer your enemy. Like they're now your friend. They're now someone you know. And so loving them has shifted. It's become this different thing. But the path there was getting to know them, sort of like becoming compassionate. So these might be the kind of ideas that we can approach in theory, right? Sort of in a head-first way, maybe like we've been doing here in the last few moments. But if we want to actually be changed or we actually want to grow in them, then we have to enter them. We have to actually practice them. And historically, that's been the center of what religions have provided a framework for or occasions for or encouragement toward or support in. Now, the thought that religions might exist to help us enter into the practice of transformative compassion might sound a little bit, or maybe a lot, far-fetched to some of us when we compare that idea to the ways that we've experienced religion in our own lives or the ways we've seen it portrayed in the world around us. I do know that this next idea isn't the whole story, but if we think for a moment about how religion is typically portrayed in the media, for instance, we might think that religion exists primarily for self-interested reasons or for combative reasons or for political reasons. I think it might be fair to say that it's pretty rare to hear a mainstream news story in which religion is viewed as a place where compassion is nurtured, where the focal point of the story is to say, wow, look at how this religion in this moment is nurturing compassion. No particular memory of that as regards media portrayals of religions comes to mind. That feels like it's a long ways away from what most religious founders or central figures taught and enacted. That religion would be portrayed as self-interested or combative or political primarily feels like it's at a great distance, a great remove from where most of those religions started, which raises the question, how did we get here? That question is beyond the scope of this exploration, but as I said in the blurb, I do want to consider some aspects of this as we can see them within the Christian tradition, since that's the one that most of us in this community know the best. And if we're wrestling to understand religion in our own lives and kind of go, what place does this have or not have? What do I do with the things I've inherited from it if I'm moving away from it? How do I practice this if I'm staying within a tradition? Those kind of questions primarily are referencing the Christian religion in our context. So that's where we're going to dig in. Over the last couple of weeks, we've talked a bit about the problem of the absolutizing of beliefs and the ways in which doing that makes those beliefs vulnerable to becoming primarily the measuring sticks for exclusivist claims. They can easily become boundary markers for who's in, who's out, with the primary or even only acceptable value then becoming doing whatever is necessary to get those who are out to become in. Religions are remarkably vulnerable to this. If we, for example, at the table, if we use language that assumes that other people in the community believe what we believe as individuals, if we have any sort of public forum, that's enough sometimes. If somebody's vulnerable to this, sensitive to this, been wounded by this, we use language that assumes certain things about the way people would perceive what is not them, would perceive mystery or divinity, the assumed personification of that, for example. Like that's all it takes to kind of have somebody experience a boundary marker. How do we handle those particularities in a way that doesn't make us feel like we need to stop believing what we believe if those are our beliefs? You know, that sort of space. There's some complexity there. We'll touch on that. One of the most potent frameworks for all of this, this kind of boundary markerishness that I was just talking about, is often framed as lostness versus foundness. Within the Christian tradition. And that can be portrayed, that lostness versus foundness can be portrayed in quite appealing ways because, among other things, it calls out the rescuer in us. It calls out the Messiah in us. And in many ways, it can even tap into that compassion value we were talking about a few moments ago if we perceive someone as lost and suffering, and we feel like we've got the answer to your lostness and your suffering, and we choose to enter into that person's life motivated by that, that's tapping into the, that compassion thing, right? And as we considered last week, this is the kind of value that can matter a lot. You know, it may even move us in discernibly helpful directions. You don't have to be a believer in Christianity, for example, to be grateful for the Misericordia Hospital's existence when you receive helpful care there. But it came into existence because of that frame of belief. So, right, that's that kind of a space. But as with any idea or value, when the particulars of it start to matter too much, when we absolutize it and we make it a boundary marker, it can behave, misbehave rather, pretty badly. In the history of Christianity, this has often gotten tangled up with a set of ideas that gets bundled into something called, often gets called salvation. And to really cut to the chase, Christian exclusivism, as many of us have encountered, it says things like, Jesus is the only way of salvation, Christianity is the only true religion, and it's important to convert the whole world to Christianity because souls are perishing. That probably sounds, at least in its broad outlines, familiar to some of us. It's interesting that that message is not at the heart of what Jesus taught. We'll explore that another time, but it's been part of conventional Christianity for centuries. And I want to look back into some of those centuries just a little bit. So if we poke around just a bit in the history of Christianity, and in this particular case, the Roman Catholic Church, because early in the history of Western Christianity, that was it. If you were a Christian, you were a Roman Catholic. That was all there was. If we look back into that bit of history, we find this Latin phrase, extra ecclesiam nulla sala est. And if you're a Latin scholar and you would pronounce that otherwise, my apologies. That translates quite directly, though, into this phrase, outside of the church, there is no salvation. Now, as a religious claim, that's pretty unambiguous. That's pretty clear. Outside of the church, there is no salvation. There we go. Full stop. And it's the kind of thing that a religion can get away with, culturally speaking, as long as that religion also has control of the prevailing means of power and influence in that culture. And that would fairly describe the cultural setting in which that doctrine came to exist, historically speaking. At the point in the history of the West where outside the church, there is no salvation became a thing in terms of a stated belief of the church. Church and state were very intertwined, and there was enormous power held by religious institutions in the general culture. Much of the culture, broadly speaking, was uneducated and couldn't in a here's our verification or the support for our ideas. They couldn't challenge those ideas, didn't challenge them in the main. And so you could say something like that, and it would be taken on. But then this thing called the Reformation happened within European Christianity, and we now had people, for the first time in terms of European Christianity, we now had people claiming to be Christians that weren't Catholic. They were Protestant. So that's a problem, a really big problem for anyone making that exclusivist claim, because the church, and outside of the church there is no salvation, is the Roman Catholic Church, right? It's not a bigger idea than that. Those are synonymous. Within the tradition that made that claim, the understanding was that everyone not inside was out of luck. So not just non-Christians were out of luck, but all non-Catholics were out of luck as regards this idea of salvation. And the Second Vatican Council radically changed that, openly affirmed that God is known in all the religious traditions of the world, but it seems sort of like the Roman Catholic Church has been backpedaling on that ever since. It depends a little bit. There's some ebb and flow there. It depends on, you know, who the Pope is. It depends on who's in charge to some degree. On the other side of the coin, if you will, because this is very much, you know, Catholic-Protestant is a binary in historic terms in lots of ways. On the other side of the coin, Protestants rejected that idea, that Catholic idea, that outside of the brackets Catholic Church, there is no salvation. They rejected that idea, probably in no small part because it rejected them, right? So the counterclaim from within Protestantism became something like, no, there's salvation outside the Catholic Church. There's salvation through Jesus, but only through Jesus. And of course, we Protestants, we've got Jesus. Which, of course, is the same type of claim, but with different details, right? It's just framed differently by a different group of people, but it's we're in, you're out. That's the shape of the claim. And that's pretty much the kind of religious exclusivist shoving match that I grew up in and around, with a lot of time and energy being spent on why the Protestant exclusivist claims were valid, but the Catholic ones were not. And why, you know, we needed to evangelize the Catholics, because otherwise, well, they were going to hell, weren't they? You know, they were out. When you stand back from it a bit, it's not that hard to see how the outlines are the same, but the content differs. And what I want to do for the balance of our time today is look at three reasons why that Protestant claim doesn't work for me personally, and also why it's problematic from within the tradition itself. All right? I'm not laying claim here to any kind of a message from God. This is one take on how this looks to me, and it's an evolving reality with my own lived experience. I'm not setting up a new boundary marker at the table. So I want to be very clear about that as well, because some people easily get confused about this. So isn't Tim the pastor? Not really. I mean, I don't know. We don't call this that, and I don't think of it in religious structural terms that way. Certainly not in vertical authoritative terms. So this is not a message. I did not see this in a vision. Nobody handed me tablets. Pick a metaphor. My hope, though, is that talking about it can lift some of the taboo from the conversation, if there is one, and enlarge the space within which we live and move and explore together in this community and outside of it. The first reason why that Protestant version of that exclusivist claim doesn't work for me feels like common sense. And I do know that common sense is not common. That's a bit of a tricky idea, because what's normal or common to me may not be common to you. So again, this is my lens on this. But here's with that caveat, here's what I mean. To me, the idea that Christianity is the only way of salvation, and salvation, by the way, of course, is its own religious idea. It's not universal. But the idea that Christianity is the only way of salvation seems like a pretty odd notion to me. If there is some kind of source, mystery, power, spirit, God behind all that is, animating all that is, why would they, if we're going to use personified language or imagery for that mystery, why would they choose to be known only in one religious tradition, which just happens to fortunately be the one held by the persons making that claim? See the problem? And when it comes to exclusivist claims, we don't have to look very hard to see that these kinds of claims tend to get narrower as they go, and we sort of get claims within claims regarding the particularities of the claimant. And what I mean by that is that it gets more and more specific. You're not really saved unless you believe X, or even you're not really saved unless you reject belief Y, or social value Y, or moral value Y, whatever it is, whatever the particulars are. I think that's pretty familiar ground to most of us. So that's reason number one. It just doesn't make sense to me that anything that is everything would be so small as to say only this understanding of that mystery is correct or complete. It's a lot of hubris, feels like, to make a claim like that. The second reason is that from within the wider considerations of the tradition, I also find it difficult to reconcile exclusivist claims. So this is from within the Christian traditional perspective. I find it difficult to reconcile exclusivist claims with the Christian notions and emphasis on grace. Within the Christian tradition, one of the most radical claims in the context of the beginnings of that tradition was this idea that the divine was an expression of radical grace. And what radical grace meant and means in that context is God's unconditional acceptance of us. Unconditional. I'm not trying to be a smart aleck here. Unconditional means no conditions. It means without conditions. But if someone had to be a Christian to be in, you know, right relationship with God, that's a requirement. That's a condition. So now we're talking about requirements and conditions, about law, which isn't grace. And then rules start to pile up, often because the institution is reacting to cultural values they don't affirm, or because as Judy mentioned this morning, because of fear, because they feel embattled and they're defending against something. So now we're into the train of you can't be a true believer slash you can't be saved unless you take a particular position on, and then fill in the cultural hot button issue here, right? And the claims get narrower and the club gets more exclusive as you go. If we want to consider this in light of the Jesus stories, it's interesting to see how this circumstance, where religious leaders are setting themselves up as authorities on who is in and who is out, what kind of rules have to be kept to stay in right relationship to God, that's exactly the kind of religious structures for which the rabbi reserved his strongest reprobation. As we have the stories, Jesus really didn't have anything good to say about this. And in fact, I would say went considerable distance the other direction. If Jesus says things, as we have the stories, that my mother would look at askance and say, that's not kind. That is not a nice thing to say. If Jesus said not nice things about anybody, it was about that group of religious leaders who were saying, we know the only true path, and we're going to tell you exactly how to stay on it. And if you step over those lines that we're talking about, you're out. That was just no space for that whatsoever. Which in some ways brings us to a consideration of what makes Christianity credible in its wider and present context, which is the third reason why those exclusivist claims, as I've encountered them in Protestant religions, don't work for me. If we've grown up or been formed in the context of what makes this religion true as these particular beliefs and cultural norms, that kind of a framework, this might be a really hard idea to consider. When Christianity claims to be the only true religion, I believe that it loses much of whatever credibility it might still have in a given context. When it is seen as one of the great religions of the world, as one that can be in dialogue with the others, as one that shares the common ground of exploring mystery, spirit, God with others, I think it might have a lot that is of interest to offer. I would circle back, for example, to that idea of grace and the idea that the divine is an expression of unqualified grace. That's an idea that upended the Greco-Roman structures for the gods. That space, that Greco-Roman space, was populated by petty, vengeful, vindictive, duplicit beings who not only had a lot of rules, but sort of capriciously enforce them, or not. The idea that the divine would be an expression of unqualified grace, wow, what a contribution to the conversation about the possibilities, right? It's not really that hard to see what the appeal might have been. In any case, that perspective, that when seen as one of the great religions of the world, there's a lot to explore here that might be of value. That, to me, that's resonant. If we think about this in terms of this image of on-ramps that I've used a few times, the discussion of how different attempts to put some forms around our approaching of the sacred have things in common and also have distinctives, how they can be seen to be products of their context and time, if we think about it that way, then the notions that exist within Christian history and tradition become more like clues in a wider search, rather than exclusivist claims to do battle over. They become entry points. They become reasons for intrigue, things to follow further. From that kind of perspective, we can celebrate the similarities between these different ways of exploring the mystery rather than resisting them. So we don't have to start out with resistance or fear. We can start out with intrigue. We can start out with celebration. We can start out with, that's beautiful. And we can be intrigued by the particulars without needing to be combative about them, without needing to compete and say, my particulars are better than your particulars. And beyond that, I would say there's a quite humbling aspect to all of this that, for me, has to do with honest self-examination of that idea of being transformed in the direction of being more compassionate. And what I mean by that is that if I honestly look at where my life experience within the Christian religion intersects with being transformed, I'm saddened by how much evidence I see that a lot of it's been about learning how to articulate and defend exclusivist claims rather than being carried deeper into being compassionate by the practices my tradition has invited me to live deeply into. Others would tell a different story. That's my story. I have a good friend who's a well-known Christian figure, a public Christian, if you will, and he recently told me a story about being invited out for lunch by another public person, well-known to be Jewish. And this was someone that had often shown up for public events at which my friend communicated openly about their Christian faith, and he figured, well, this is where I find out that they're offended by something I've said or I've done in the process of talking about my faith, my views of the world and of God and all of that. But he said yes. I mean, this was someone he had a relationship with, and he was curious, and so they went out for lunch together. And they had a lovely lunch together. Religion really never came up in the conversation. There was a lot of other points of engagement in the world around them that they talked about, but nothing sort of specifically religious. And as their time was coming to a close and those kind of topics still hadn't come up, my friend sort of couldn't take it anymore. And so he asked about it. It was just kind of churning around in there. And he said something along the lines of, I figured you wanted to take me out for lunch so you could tell me about some way that I'd offended you or crossed the line or something like that. And this other person's response, as the story was told to me, really sticks with me. They said something along the lines of, oh, I've got no problem with how you talk about your religion because you just tell me your stories. You tell me how this works for you. If you start trying to tell me my story or how this should be for me, that'll be another matter. That I would have a problem with. I'd be out of here. I love that story. And one of the reasons I love it is because it so illustrates what I've been trying to explore these past weeks. This idea that there are ways to be engaged in the realms of belief, even of religion in the organized or institutional sense, there are ways to be engaged in that that can keep us open and curious and in dialogue, that can keep us as people that are growing and being transformed into more compassionate persons rather than being constrained from those things or feeling like our energy is going toward becoming more combative or defensive or exclusivist. That is, in the spirit of that last illustration, that is my story. And it may not be yours. It's my story, and in this context, I have a more frequent and a more amplified voice than other people in the community, which I hope can serve us all well. And I also know by experience does not serve everyone well all of the time, and maybe no one well all of the time. But that's my hope. My strong desire and motivation, even when I do things that don't seem like they are consistent with that from your perspective, my strong motivation and desire is to continue to make the world in which we explore what we believe bigger, more generous. How could you out generous something like unconditional grace? So, for example, if you want to take that particular Christian notion as a valid one in your search or one with merit in your exploration, just that one, that's inexhaustible. As soon as we hit something that feels like it's exhausting it, it's a condition. We're no longer talking about something that's unconditional. We're now talking about something that we define and we decide about, conditions. So, to me, an idea like that remains a rich and potent realm of exploration, one that I should be able to live into with all of my being transformed into a more compassionate person by the living into of it and never exhaust it. Maybe that's not your story. Maybe just that word has so much religious connotation in hurtful contexts that you need another way. You need a different story. That's the big world that I'm talking about wanting to live in. That's what creates the possibility, in my imagination at least, of a crowded table, one where everyone is welcome. And the pictures don't all have to hang the same way or look all tidied up. We can just come as we are and explore what we believe together. I hope we get to do this for a long time. There's lots to explore, and I look forward to sharing the journey with you all.